You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 424, do we really want more music more often from our favourite bands? New boots and football shorts, we scroll through the online pages of The Athletic. And what's the deal with Prince Harry? That's all coming up after Big Audio Dynamite and E equals MC squared.
Why don't you play the tune? I don't like music.
Somebody I never met, but in a way I know. Didn't think that you could get so much from a picture show. Man dies, birds, real people lost. What's the deal? This ain't how it's supposed to be. Don't like no aborigine. Took a trip in Power Square, pop star died as hell. No fans are screaming, shouting, monsters came and flush him out. Gangland's laying on the ground, new identity must be found. On the left hand for a while, insanity, bohemian style. Dressed like Little Red Riding Hood, bad habit, taking life, a calling card, a six-inch knife, ran off, really far, mumbled something about the past, best sex I've ever seen, as if each moment was a loss, drops of blood, colour side, funeral for his bride, but it's him who's really dead, gets to take the funeral ride with.
Often described as a form of side project for Mick Jones, but they actually outlasted The Clash in terms of longevity. A single taken from their first album, it reached number 11 on the UK Top 40 in 1986, Big Audio Dynamite and E equals MC squared.
I do like the riff to that. I find that to be very cheery, that song. I don't know if the subject's actually cheery or not. I don't think I've ever listened to the lyrics closely, but it does always. I'm always pleased to hear it, that record.
Yes, I agree. I've never analysed it very much, but it just gives you a little spring in the step.
It does. It's a very boosting song. I like that. Well done, Mick Jones and Associates.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 424. I'm Terence Stackham, and here she is, the Greta Thunberg of podcasting. It's Juliet Harris.
Thank you very much. I wish I was as fabulous as Greta Thunberg, of whom inevitably I am a huge admirer. I found an excellent, I think it came from my much loved Facebook page, Simpsons Fans Against the Conservatives, which is very much the Venn diagram of my interest some weeks. And they had an excellent comparison of when Donald Trump was in The Simpsons, there was a picture of Lisa Simpson squinting at Donald Trump rather angrily. And then almost exactly the same shot with the real Donald Trump and Greta Thunberg looking at him very stonily during the week. So what can I say? Two of my favourite, most inspiring girls in one picture. So yes, hello everybody. I'm not as cool as Greta.
She does have some great facial expressions.
She does, and it's a great example of somebody who is on the sort of what they call the spectrum, so the autistic Asperger's spectrum, but is extra special, if you see what I mean. It has a way of making their kind of individual circumstances work for them, I think.
For sure. Now, as we know, our newish feature is causing a sensation throughout the world.
It is. Everyone's doing the guest the singer.
Absolutely. It's rivaling, I think, The Chase and Family Feud with its popularity.
Absolutely. Or Family Fortunes for those of us UK people.
Exactly. Now, you, the listener, and you, the Juliet Harris.
Yeah, the Juliet Harris. Not just any Juliet Harris, can I point out. Yep.
You have to try and spot the singer from a 30-second clip and without using Shazam or SoundHound. So, for spot the singer number 4, who is this from 1966, creating this interesting cover of a Beatles hit?
He's got a good reason for taking the easy way out. He's got a good reason for taking the easy way out. 'Cause I'm a dance ripper, a one-way ticket, yeah. It took him so
So, who was that 1966 really hip and funky cool version of Day Tripper?
I wonder. I mean, I can't. I was trying to work it out. I think I might know this, but equally I might be horribly wrong. I have a number of Beatles cover versions by Nancy Sinatra. Is it Nancy Sinatra?
It's not. She did cover Day Tripper, and that was actually when I thought, oh, shall I use that one? But I thought this would be far more interesting because this person that we've just heard, she was 73 years old in 1966.
Is it Nana Mouskouri?
No. But you're heading more in the you're in the right sort of time zone, I suppose. And the album, this 73 years old, 1966. The album also had on it, it featured cover versions of "Shaking All Over" and "Twist and Shout" from the album "Way Out West." It's Mae West.
Oh, how interesting. That is really interesting.
She was 73. And here's the thing. The album peaked at 116 on Billboard's Hot 200 LP chart in 1966. So it wasn't a complete write-off.
No, it didn't do badly at all. That is incredible. That is really interesting. Also, if we're talking about covers of Day Tripper, very, very keen on the Sergio Mendes cover of Day Tripper, which
with
is
Brazil 66.
Yes, or it's really good. I've just been recently, well, funny enough, I have the cushiest number in the world, which is cat sitting and cat feeding, basically going around in my lunch hour during work to feed cats to two good friends of mine that live in Bexhill, who pay me in records.
Well, that's
so last time I got paid with a Bjork single, amongst other things. This time I've been prepaid with several LPs with Beatles covers on and jazz covers. People like Ramsey Lewis and also soul covers, the Deirdre Wilson Tabak's great version of Get Back. So I'm sorry that Mae West didn't make those LPs.
Even if you don't know the answer to my next question, I think you might be able to guess it. So what's Mae West's other connection with the Beatles?
Oh, is she on the front cover of Sgt. Pepper?
She is. That's the answer. She's on the front cover of Sgt. Pepper.
I'm up on that only because there was recently a Only Connect first round question where you had to put four people together, and I think she was one of them. The answer was they were on the cover of Sgt. Pepper. So who knows? Maybe there is quizzing life in this old dog left yet.
Yeah. Actually, back in the days when George Martin and the Beatles, they led a revolution in recorded music. Their output was prolific. Nobody made money from touring, so record sales were the way to go. And in 6 years together, in terms of recording, the Beatles released 13 studio albums in six years.
That's so more than two a year. That's really hit, isn't it? That's a real hit rate.
Often they were just a few months apart. They might release one in August, the next one in time for Christmas. So, but by the 1970s, with the advent of more sophisticated recording equipment, increasingly it became the vogue to spend a long time creating one's masterpiece and then take a long break, years and years in some cases, as compared to that 60s ethos of, well done, lads, you finished the album, time to start on the next one.
Yeah.
Now, Jules, this week, you're The Guardian is arguing that we are returning to the old days where musicians are under pressure to produce more and more new music, returning to the two albums a year process. And it seems if you don't keep climbing the ladder, then you're going to fall off.
Yeah, it does seem to be that way, doesn't it? It's interesting. We saw this kind of... This, you could argue, is what did for Britpop, really. And I think that even Steve Lamacq has admitted this, which is that you had the first wave of Britpop bands that were really successful in the sort of early to beginning mid-90s. And then those bands being sort of rock bands rather than pop bands, although, you know, some uncharitably might argue that some cases were very poppy, but being allegedly more serious music bands, it meant that they would actually go away and write their own albums, as a result of which you'd have someone like The Verve who Oasis bucked the trend, actually, but you'd go away and have someone like The Verve who'd release an album in 93-94 and then they wouldn't come back until 97, and actually that's what it did for Elastica in the end as well. It was interesting that it actually affected the quality of pop music, because you suddenly, indie music had suddenly become mainstream, which meant it was suddenly subject to sort of pop rules and pop economics, which meant that you suddenly had this new audience that just suddenly decided they really loved Britpop and they couldn't get enough of this Britpop stuff, you know, and they loved Oasis and they liked the Pulp album, they liked the Blur album, they really liked the Elastica album. Then all of a sudden those bands went off to do second records, although Oasis's second album came out pretty quickly, actually, but these bands went off and did their next records. So the music industry was left with this whole kind of gang of Britpop fans and nothing to feed them, which was why lots of, it has to be said, pretty mediocre bands then popped up in their place, because they, what do you feed these new fans? Unfortunately, the answer tended to be any old crap in some places, but that's kind of where we were. And it seems like that's where we are now. I noticed that your man from Foles, Yanis, Philip Harkis, I think his name is. I've seen Foles, by the way, and they're excellent. He kind of says that he's sort of hinting that it might be the internet that's the problem. So we seem to have moved away from this kind of sort of hard copy music sales, and things have gone online and become streaming, which means that stuff being released is less of an event. It's then dropped onto the internet pretty regularly, as a result of which it seems like music's a constant arms race all the time now, that you're constantly hairing after everybody else, because it is so easy to get music up online that the competition is almost endless now, because it's not up to record companies to find the next big thing to replace you anymore. It just seems to kind of pop up organically, really. So it does feel to me like it is much more competitive now due to new technologies.
I suppose the rise of streaming like Spotify has led to
changed everything, I think.
Yeah, a sort of mathematical, simple mathematical equation in that the more music you have available, the more chance you have of it getting streamed. I continue to be surprised that albums still have any sort of currency, because they originally became the norm as 12-inch vinyl records.
Yeah.
They could hold about 40 minutes of music. And so therefore, you would get, what, 12 three-minute-ish pop songs. And
that became the way maybe to... 10 four-minute songs if you were a bit more serious. But yeah,
that's right. That became the way to sell records. But since iTunes in America unpacked single songs, so you no longer had to buy a whole album for one song you like, which always felt, you know, really kind of grim. You thought, oh, I heard one song on the radio somewhere. You went out and bought the album because you thought that's going to be good. And then you brought it home and it's like 11 duffers and the one track that you like. So you didn't have to do that anymore. And those, I always think that those longer form album formats, therefore, should be redundant, and even more so on streaming. It's a very small minority of artists, though, who can sustain the production of 10 or 12 tracks with no filler and get that out once or twice a year in a 10-year career span. Of course, as ever, though, money will drive this this cart. So although artistically it makes sense to write, record and release individual songs, as I say, if you feel they merit it, but if there's profit in swamping us in album after album, then saturated market, that'll only increase.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, it was interesting, this chap from Folgianis went on to say that he thinks there's a greater demand for artists to create as much as possible to fill streaming services. And it's almost a direct reverse situation where Foles were a decade ago, because they've been going quite a while, Foles. And also, in a way, weirdly, the direct sort of reverse to, oh, you can only put so much stuff on an album. There is no limit, like you say, there is no limit to streaming, is there? There is no, we haven't found, there's no, the internet isn't full yet and probably never will be. And he actually says, there was a period where iTunes was the main gatekeeper, and they would stop paying after a certain amount of tracks on a record. In general, labels were dissuading artists from making longer albums because you didn't get paid for the extra tracks. Streaming has totally dismantled that. So that is rather surprising, isn't it, really? And I don't know as well, there's another angle to this, which is in this Guardian article, which I found really interesting, which is this move towards well, partly it's the way that we, when we've talked before about the way that we consume things now, and the way that things are now streamed, and like you said, the individual tracks and that you can now get, it all sums up to when we talk about, I don't want this to be the weekly Blame the Millennials podcast, but when we talk about how people live differently now, it's like attention spans are much shorter than they were, I think. And I think that there is that worry now compared to the olden days, that because there's much more music available, there's much more competition, and people don't stick with, or it seems like people don't stick with things for so long. It is an enormous risk going away for 2 or 3 years, because when you come back, there'll be three times as many people to fill your place than there would have been even 20 years ago, I would say. So I think it's partly people can't concentrate on things for very long. Either they forget about you when you go for 2 or 3 years, or they get to track 7 of your album and think, oh, I'm bored now. So it's partly that. And also, this Matt Healy from the 1975, who I have to be honest, I often find quite tedious, but fair play to him. he is trying to think about being environmentally active. Right. And so he has done a collaboration with Greta, funny enough, Greta Thunberg and her family. And he has said that as a result of which they have a sense of urgency about wanting to release the music, partly because, you know, of the urgency in the situation, and partly because if you're writing songs about topical issues, you've got to get that material out as soon as possible, because otherwise it dates. So that's an idea as well, I think.
Coming next, there's a new player in sports journalism. We scroll through the pages of The Athletic. That's right after Dust Junkies. We gotta kick it. We gotta kick it. Show you right. We gotta kick it. We gotta kick it.
Now let me kick it. 7-9 summertime rhyme. Wonder Mike slammed and the tunes got wild. Styles be dropping silly up on an old school track. Beatboxing bubbling on a freestyle rap. Where were you at? Well, we were getting live. Rock the house crew, kicking city street rhymes. Stick 'em, ha ha ha, stick 'em. That's what we're doing when the fat boy's tripping. Paid my dues strictly on a rhyme tip. So I can boast toast a box if I feel it. So, are you down? Are you with me? Are you ready to rinse it?
Trust me.
You got the flow that I need?
Plenty.
Now why's that?
Cause we all just jump.
Proper dopper, non-stopper, the hip-hopper. Since I was a youth, I've been a bad body popper. Windmiller, the caterpillar, the backflipper. Dep on the microphone, I be the dance floor filler. Zoomed into my skills like damn. Only 15 with a microphone in my hand. Check it, the spin masters come faster. In the mid-80s, I carry the ghetto blaster. Back in the days of Twilight and Maze, summer loving on those hot sunny days. The T, the U, the N, the E, the S, we were the click. And now we got the KG, yes, so are you down, are you with me?
Believe.
Well, I'm already for rinsing.
Trust me.
You got the flow that I need.
Plenty.
Now why's that?
Cause we all got junkies.
Jimmy, Jimmy, y'all. Jimmy, 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 J. Hey. Hey. Jimmy, Jimmy, y'all.
13 years ago, a friend of mine passed me the mic and I got busy on the front line. Bang, bang, boom, boom, rhymes love you long time. Sucky licky with the chickies out on the back.
Wow.
Go crush and flash, P-Funk, Barry White, strike a bird, pull it, pass it all night. We're still a 2 and it's 10 years gone. The double J shine on me and now the KG's on. Talent, you don't got a whiff. We'll be rocking the microphone and watching y'all slip. So, are you down? Are you with me?
Believe.
Are you ready to rinse it?
Trust me.
You got the flow that I need?
Plenty.
Now why's that?
Cause we all got junkies.
Freestyle, it's time to let this rap unfold. Hip-hop is growing, a trillion albums sold. With Big Daddy Kane, it was a passing me by. Scoop a scrap. Lover, damn the shit's fly. Truly hip hops till I go. The family foundation hooked me up with a show.
Heads up low.
Made every move like a pro. I took the dance floor and I'm taking a mic. Yo. So what you think about the KG MC? Free vibes to everybody.
Body.
Straight from the breaks to the swings. I'm doing my things naturally because I be what I be. Mixing it up with the no school click. We don't talk shit and then abandon ship. So while you're down, are you with me?
Believe.
Are you ready to rinse it?
Trust me.
You got the flow that I need.
Plenty.
Now why's that?
Cause we all got junkies.
Jimmy, Jimmy, y'all.
Now, the eagle-eared amongst our listeners, I'm sure, of whom there are very many, will have spotted a certain line that rang very familiar in there, I should think. And I'm trying to roll out my own semi-occasional feature to get some road back from the rolling juggernaut that is Guess the Singer. Or let's face it, that is the real all-time winner. This is like when the mighty X Factor crushed everything on ITV and the BBC tried to wheel out the voice. And then it wasn't very successful. I am the voice of this podcast, I feel. I'm trying to introduce a little bit of songs that have a sample or something that's been sampled and then playing the song with the sample in it. So that you would recognise the line, I suspect, but we'll tell you, we'll kind of reveal what it was properly later. But that was the Dust Junkies and that was Beatbox Car Wash.
Yeah, that was new to me, but I did recognise elements of it from elsewhere, as you're going to, as you say, reveal later.
Yes.
There was a time not too long ago when sports reporting for newspapers, it consisted of a bloke going to a football match and then phoning through a factual report of the game with almost no analysis. And that phoned-in report would be typed up and reproduced in the following day's newspapers. Now, in the modern era, to keep up with... Well, what at least at the moment feels like an insatiable demand for football-related news. Most newspapers have either a lengthy sports section or a sports pullout, which is more like a mini newspaper in itself, mirroring the daily sports newspapers that are common in mainland Europe.
Mm.
Now, with such a proliferation of coverage available, both in print and through the online versions of these newspapers, it would seem like a bold move for a new player to have a go at sports journalism. The Athletic has recently launched in the UK. It's advertisement free, it's online only, and has some interesting names working for it. And we may only read it through a paid subscription. So it's a paywall. Jules, you've been scrolling through the Athletic website. Is it meeting its mission as it describes itself of producing smarter coverage for diehard fans?
Well, I have to say, I have been enjoying a week's free trial of The Athletic this week, and I have been rather enjoying it, I must admit. As much as I like to put, as much as we like to poo-poo new things on this podcast wherever we possibly can, I thought it was very interesting, like you say, that one thing that I was particularly struck by is how many big names they've managed to get. So we've had they've poached a few from The Guardian, there's been one from The Times, one from The Telegraph. The football writers particularly are of very high standards. One thing I did like about, a thing I liked about it very much was the fact that you, when you first sign up to it, it asks you what you're interested in. Right. So you can pick certain things. So you can pick leagues to follow, teams to follow, sports to follow, that sort of things. And then it tries to kind of tailor your offering. So it will give you push notifications saying there's this article. So I found that quite good I thought the algorithm worked reasonably well. So it was a little bit like, you know, those Amazon things. If you liked this CD, you might like this album or something. And I thought that was quite interesting. I think we've talked a little bit when it very first came on the scene. I think we tried to have a think about whether or not it then results in you. And you could argue the same thing about actually Amazon algorithms and algorithms, if I'm going to say it properly, and Spotify and things like that. That do you then end up losing out on the joy of discovering stuff by accident, which I do all the time listening to Six Music, which I love, if you then end up just being sent stuff that it thinks you'll like all the time, rather than just scrolling through and thinking, oh, I don't know anything about kite surfing, I'll read that, and then it turns out to be really interesting. So I worry that it makes you more narrow in scope, a little bit like bubbles on Twitter as well. Do you just end up reading stuff and following stuff that you're particularly interested in or agree with? But I think the quality of the writing's very good, and I have enjoyed the articles that I've read so far.
I will remain sceptical, though I really hope it succeeds. Any serious sports journalism is always welcome, but my scepticism is based on two fronts. Firstly, with so much sports coverage available free online, for example, the BBC and The Guardian give all their journalism away for free, will people be willing to pay monthly or annual subscriptions in the long term? But secondly, and I think this is perhaps even more important for their future, these days, all of the top clubs closely control what information is given to the media. They're very wary, so they release information through their own websites and social media, and they restrict the press to the obligatory press conferences once or twice a week before big games. Now, even if the Athletic employ a full-time reporter to follow, For example, Manchester City, from the stadium to the training ground, where presumably they'll have to be left shivering on the corner of a public road, waiting for, kind of begging Raheem Sterling to stop and give them a quote. It's very unlikely. I can't see how they're going to turn up anything new each day to satisfy their readership, and bearing in mind they're paying for it through the subscription. And it would be counterproductive for them if they went for, which is already available, the really grim things that keep popping up on Facebook with kind of daily clickbait, sensational, untrue headlines.
But
Athletic's got a tough journey ahead, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, yeah, like you say, it is a bit of an uphill struggle. Having said that, the journalism that I've read so far has been very thoughtful. So I really hope, like you say, that it manages somehow to find a way of high quality analysis and to find a way through that. Perhaps its future, because you can follow leagues as well, perhaps its future might lie. They don't just report about individual clubs. I have read articles about sort of how leagues work and things like that, and different aspects of women's football. So maybe if they can try and keep it a little bit broad, that might help them. I really hope it does succeed, actually, because I hope there is a place for quality sports journalism still. I do think it's right ultimately to pay for journalism, and I am trying to do that now as much as I can. There are a couple of football fanzines I've very much been enjoying, one of which is called The Football Pink, which is excellent, by the way. I would recommend that. And it's really, they do them in fairly small runs. It's, yes, it is reasonably expensive. It's about £5 or £6, but it is beautifully presented. So, I want, if you want good quality stuff, ultimately, as we've learned, you have to pay for it. So, I wish The Athletic were, and I have enjoyed reading it, and I might well maintain my subscription.
I wish them well also. As I say, I do hope it succeeds, but well, we'll see. We'll maybe put a marker in the diary for this time next year and see if it's still thriving.
I hope then, so, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Prince Harry says he finds it hard to get out of bed in the mornings. Millions of teenagers cheer in sympathy. that's next, right after Butterfly Boucher. There is like a latter-day Todd Rundgren. She's a singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, record producer. This was from her debut album, Flutter By. As a single, it was what record companies like to call a radio hit. Mm. And it was all over the radio back in 2003-04, certainly in America. Butterfly Boucher and Another White Dash.
I really liked that. And I actually, it rang a very vague bell when I heard it, but yes, I very much welcome the people who that is indeed your real name, as someone would say. There's something about it I rather like. Yeah, like Sunshine Anderson. There needs to be more people with interesting names.
Her full name is Butterfly Giselle Grace Boucher.
That is an excellent name.
Terrific name. Now, I have a degree of sympathy for members at the heart of the royal family, not the hangers-on and the grifters.
Yeah, absolutely.
But certainly for Prince Charles, William, Harry, they didn't seek the crown. Royalty was thrust upon them from birth.
Absolutely.
And consequently, if they put a foot even slightly out of step, the headlines and the stories would haunt them for the rest of their lives. This week, Prince Harry spoke about how he feels overwhelmed by all the troubles in the world. Now, some of the media restricted themselves to merely reporting his views. But Rod Liddell, writing in The Sun, said that, and I quote, "Privileged Prince Harry's whining about struggling to get out of bed is getting people down," unquote. Now, Liddell's point is that people who should... There may be something to this. Little's point is that people who should really find it hard to get out of bed are those who don't know where they'll be sleeping the next night or where their next meal is coming from. Whereas Harry is, let's be honest, an immensely rich, immensely privileged white male. Where do you stand on this, Jules? With Harry and his worries about the world, or should he help more directly by selling that huge house in Windsor Great Park and giving the money to the poorest people in Botswana, where he was this week?
Well, and I mean, I try to avoid agreeing with Rod Liddell wherever possible, so I will make no exception here. I feel for Prince Harry and for people in rich and privileged positions, or people in the public eye that are trying to lead a good life and a moral life and a thoughtful life. They're often damned if they do and damned if they don't, because if he spent his whole life on a jet ski or shooting things, he would then be accused of, you know, of not caring about the... I'm sure that would be wrong in some way. Yet when him and Meghan Markle, as was, talk about sort of... They seem to be doing genuinely thoughtful initiatives. They then are criticised for, you know, being do-gooders or preaching or hypocrites. I think... Yeah, I mean, I have some sympathy with the fact that there are people that have very hard lives. But equally... mental health is something that affects us all, I think. I think that actually Prince Harry and Prince William have used their positions in the public eye very well in talking about mental health, and they've been very sort of, I hate to use the word brave because it shouldn't have to be brave, but they've been very thoughtful on that. And it is, I mean, I think it has been incredibly hard to be Prince Harry in the public eye, particularly having lost their mother so young in the whole view of the whole world as you know, as children, essentially. It is, as you say, they didn't choose that. He didn't choose that life as a child, and they're now trying to navigate it as adults. I have sympathy with him. I often feel overwhelmed by the problems in the world. I must admit, it's a very depressing time to live through, both if you live in Britain and if you live elsewhere, frankly. It's very troubling. If you are a progressive person, it's a hard time, and and I can understand that, and I like the fact that he is trying to think about the world and wants to make it a better place. In a way, I would much rather, yes, you know, even if you're not a fan of the royal family, they are there and they have that position in society, and also particularly the royal family continue to be really quite popular. It, as much as sort of semi-lazy Republicans like me don't like them very much, although I have softened on them over the years, I must admit, they are, you know, when you ask if the monarchy should still be kept, it still scores in the high 60s in Britain. So they are popular, which means they do still have a reach and people will listen to what they have to say. And so given that there is that, I would rather that the person that is in that position, I'm much sure they were thinking about that than they were thinking about sort of what yacht they were going to buy or something. So maybe there are other things that he could do. But having said that, if he is in that position, the fact that he is at least thinking about those things is helpful, I think.
It's helpful, but I find it a little bit difficult. As I said, I've got sympathy for him and the world he was born into. It's not of his making. But he and the Duchess may need to rethink the way they are portrayed, because they want to be seen to care about all the troubles in the world. I've no doubt they do care. But there is a mismatch when you give speeches about climate change, yet circle the globe in gas-guzzling private jets.
Yeah.
And when you speak about inequality in the world, which he does, and then your driver takes you back to Frogmore Cottage, which sounds humble, but it's in fact five separate cottages converted into a luxury home at a cost to the taxpayer, by the way, of £2.4 million.
Gosh,
now, that,
right, yes.
That could have bought a lot of medicine for the people of Botswana. It may be an unfair comparison, but it's still the truth. The country that he loves, Botswana. I know having money and privilege doesn't mean you can't also have a conscience, but there is a bit of a gap between what he says and what he does.
Yeah, I have some sympathy with that. I mean, it's I think politicians are finding this at the moment, really. You know, to what extent do you try and break the system that you're in, and to what extent do you try and work in its confines? It's and I can imagine that actually sometimes, although there is a great deal of privilege to it, there is a heavy price to pay for that, as unfortunately Harry's late mother ultimately found out, and it's difficult. You can't always ride the tiger and then have it as a pet, if you see what I mean. And it's a system that can trap you as much as it can free you, if you see what I mean. I'm not saying, you know, oh, poor Prince Harry, but equally, it's not always as easy as that. And if you come from that kind of background where you have the sense of duty that the royals have, and you know, you've always lived your life that you are entitled to be like that, it must feel almost alien to live your life in a completely different way.
Absolutely. I couldn't disagree with that. Now, as ever, thanks very much for listening.
Yes, I can't believe that you still do, but thank you ever so much. We're very grateful.
Thanks to Rona and Hilly.
As always.
Now, that's a throwback, as we said, to the track we heard earlier as we head off, Jules.
Indeed, yes. The hook line about the fat boy tripping is I think what people would have spotted. I actually first came across this, the original song, the Beatbox Junkies, on a CD that my friend lent me in the late 90s early noughties, called A Break from the Norm, which is worth digging out. I think I'm not sure how available it is now, but I'm sure you can probably pick it up from sources online, Discogs or similar. That was basically a compilation of all of the songs, mostly 60s and 70s funk and soul, with this Beatbox Junkies exception, that Fatboy Slim had sampled for his hits. Sliced Tomatoes by the Just Brothers, which is actually Check It Out Now, the Funk Soul Brother. So interestingly, it's there are lots of different bits there that you can kind of pick out. The other riff for this, by the way, the do 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 do, is actually You Did It by Anne Robinson, not to be confused with the Weakest Link host. And I nearly picked that, but I thought I'd pick the Beatbox Junkies bit instead because I thought it was interesting. But the record that sampled both of those is Gangsta Trippin' by Fatboy Slim.
What doing when a fat boy tripping? What you win when a fat boy's ripping? What you win when a fat boy's ripping?
listening to a Parish Council production.